So where are we heading? This is the best opportunity to rethink capitalism we'll ever have in our lifetimes. Capitalism is working just as it is designed to. Every few decades, we have crises. Remember the savings and loan debacle in 1989 and all the bailouts then. This was another banking crisis of capitalism. Remember the dot-com bubble. One part of the crisis had been blamed on globalization, especially part of the corporate-centered variety we've been in. But it's much more basic than that. It's just another crisis of capitalism, and if we muddle through this one, there'll be another one in our lifetimes, or a worse one in our children's or our grandchildren's lifetimes. Actually, I think it will come sooner, since we've been neglecting the second law of thermodynamics for a long time, and it is catching up with major climatic changes.
That's Stephen Bezruchka, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Stephen Bezruchka on capitalism and health. Hardly a day goes by when citizens of the United States are not told that they enjoy, a kind of funny word to use, the best health care system in the world. There may be some chauvinism at work in this claim, but to the extent that it is true, there's a huge qualifier. As long as you've got money and full insurance. Why full insurance? Tens of millions have such inadequate coverage that they'd go bankrupt if anything serious should happen. Is healthcare a right or just another commodity subject to market fluctuations to be bought and sold? As long ago as 1944, FDR said that healthcare was a right. A few years later, Truman tried to advance a national health plan. He got nowhere. Our healthcare system is located in a political economy known as capitalism, often euphemistically called the free market. And because of that, it is private and profit-driven. The critical question which should be posed is capitalism an efficient, cost-effective economic model which produces desirable health outcomes? Supporters of the status quo say it's working just fine. Critics are not so generous. They say, if you've got the bread, you get the care, and if you don't, see you in the ER or in the morgue. To address these vital issues is Stephen Bezruchka. Stephen Bezruchka teaches at the University of Washington and works as an emergency room physician in Seattle. His particular areas of research are population health and societal hierarchy. He's the author of numerous articles and essays. His most recent contribution is to Sickness and Wealth, a book on the effects of global corporatization on health. Stephen Bezruchka spoke in Edmonds, Washington.
I've been coming here in the summer for many years, beginning in 2003, and talking about population health issues. These deal mostly with our health as a nation and try to present the idea that for living in the world's richest and most powerful country in history, we die much younger than we should, given that we spend half of the world's health care bill to achieve this. I've tried to explore why by demonstrating that a country's gap between the rich and the poor is a strong determinant of its health. I've talked about the lack of evidence for medical care being all that important and about early life, the years before we make any conscious decisions for our health as being critical. Early life lasts a lifetime, is how my students put it. I've also talked about the United States having the most mental illness in the world, as well as the most treatment for mental illness, and how that represents a paradox. This past year has been an exciting time to be in this country. Not only has it been a period of great political changes, but it's been a really stimulating time to understand how our country works. The Made in USA global economic crisis is a great learning opportunity, and perhaps it is good in other ways that you might consider after my talk. I've just come back from Nepal, where I've also spent maybe a quarter of my last 40 years, and I was presenting some of these ideas that I'll talk about today. They don't really understand how this country works, and they're trying to write a new constitution for themselves to direct how Nepal will be governed in the next few decades. So my goal today is to tell you how the epic recession that we're in now came about and what recessions do for our health. How did our recession come about and what might be the health impacts? To begin with, all of us in this room are experts in understanding our economic crisis and what needs to be done about it. That is, no one is really an expert. Just think that with all these really smart people who won Nobel Prizes and direct the economy of our country and the world, none of them forecast this would happen. People did forecast it, but they weren't the acknowledged experts, and nobody paid any attention to them. So I say experts aren't. We all have to think for ourselves and make some sense of what has happened to our world and why. I tell my students to try to simplify all of their ideas and present them succinctly. So here's my short version. The economic crisis happened because employers didn't want to pay workers' salaries and instead asked them to borrow their wages. It is one of the ways our capitalist system works, namely by having everyone pursue their own greed, as Adam Smith wrote a few hundred years ago. But the rich and powerful are just more greedy than the rest of us, and they tend to get their way most times. So in one sense, what is happening is just how capitalism is supposed to work, with booms and busts, crises and wars and instability and endless competition and the creation of great wealth and of great poverty. Just in case you think poverty has ended in the world, I want to quote the words of an economic historian who wrote a book called A Farewell to Obs, A Brief Economic History of the World, in which he writes, quote, "There walk the earth now both the richest people who've ever lived and the poorest," end of quote. That observation is not an accident. It is planned. So how did it happen? Back in the 1920s, the richest 1% of Americans had close to half of all the wealth in the nation. 1/100th of our population had half of everything. The Carnegies and the Fords and the other magnates then. But because of policies that came about to bring them down a few notches, such as the New Deal in the 1930s and the GI Bill after the Second World War and another war, the War on Poverty, the wealth of the richest 1% had shrunk to half of that. In fact, by 1975, 1% of the country had become impoverished, so they only had 24% of all the wealth. The value of their holdings had dropped in half. It was because we'd put in place a series of political policies that included high tax rates and forms of redistribution that helped the rest of us economically. Recall that in the late 1940s, the highest tax rate for the wealthiest was 94%. That is, if they made $1 million a year and then made another dollar, the government would take 94 cents of it and share it with you and I. That was pretty fair. The rich, of course, have always only wanted one thing throughout history, and that is everything. So by the 1950s, the highest tax rate was only 91%, and then 70% in the 1960s, and they kept whittling it down until now it is about 35%. Sometime after the Second World War, the rich didn't like seeing their wealth share decline. You can imagine how awful it must have been. Gee, Mama, instead of having half, we only have a quarter. It isn't fair. Of course, now you know that the richest 1% of this nation again have half of all the wealth. Yes, they got it back, but how? There's an old Chinese saying about the difference between someone who is rich or well off and someone who is a poor peasant who both want to eat roast duck. For a rich person, he orders a roast duck and there it is. But a peasant must stand a long time on the hillside with his mouth open before a roast duck flies in. It's no secret. Except for Bernie Madoff, most of the rich have been very explicit in their quest to get everything. It's well written up in the business press. You don't have to think there's a conspiracy afoot. Business Week, October 12, 1974, wrote, "It will be a hard pill for many Americans to swallow, the idea of doing with less so that big business can have more. Nothing that this nation or any other nation has done in modern economic history compares in difficulty with the selling job that must now be done to make people accept the new reality." Historian Arnold Toynbee, filled with years and compassion, laments that democracy will be unable to cope with approaching economic problems and that totalitarianism will take its place. End of quote. That's Business Week in 1974. Now, that is pretty clear. We Americans have to do with less so big business can have more. They don't mince words. How are they going to get us to do with less so they can have more? We have to be sold that it is good for us. We have to accept this. Their words are abundantly clear. The sell job was very explicit. Big business is no longer going to pay your salary. You're going to have to borrow your pay. I know that's preposterous, not paying workers and asking them to borrow their pay, but that is what happened. Let me explain. Wages in the United States rose from about 1820 to about 1970 in line with productivity. By wages rising, I mean in inflation-adjusted dollars. You made more stuff, you worked harder, and for producing more, you got more pay. You lived in a better lifestyle than before. Recall that in the 1950s, we had the highest standard of living in the world, and how we boasted this to our great enemy, Russia. Recall Nikita Khrushchev taking off his shoe in the United Nations in 1960 and pounding it on the table to show how Russia was going to beat the U.S. Well, now Russia has the second largest number of billionaires in the world, but it is far behind the United States, where we have half, almost half of all the billionaires. And since making the transition to a capitalist economy after 1991, Russia has both great wealth and huge amounts of poverty, just like the capitalist system is supposed to produce. But since the 1970s, worker wages haven't risen, while productivity, how much workers produce, has skyrocketed. We're working harder and getting nothing more in return. That was the great sell job that Business Week wrote about. We were told that only the rich should get lots of money from their work, but not us. Don't believe what I'm telling you. If it's at all important, you have to try and figure it out for yourself. It's really quite easy, since pretty well everyone agrees that worker wages have been flat for about 40 years. So how did we cope? Studies comparing a typical two-parent, two-child family in the 1970s found that with one parent working and the other staying at home, that they had more money for pleasure, called discretionary income by economists, after paying for what are called fixed costs, such as mortgage, rent, childcare, food, health care costs, education, and such, than a two-parent, two-child family in 2000 with both parents working. You can imagine how hard this became and how little time there was to spend with children, family, and friends. So we cope by working longer hours, by working two or three jobs, which is pretty common among those Americans who still have jobs. That is, they work as much as they can since they get paid so little and have to make ends meet to buy luxuries that define the American lifestyle. You know, the big screen TV, the two garage car, the McMansion, and all the toys and so on. Now that worked pretty well, working overtime and two or three jobs, but then the other person in the family also had to go to work. So now we have a huge proportion of women working today. They do all sorts of jobs, and childcare is now outsourced or left undone. So as the study pointed out, by 2000, with both parents working, they didn't have as much money left over as they did 30 years ago. What do you do when the pool's salary doesn't cut it? Well, you go and borrow your salary, and that is what we did. Now, housing prices were going up, so the idea was that if you maxed out on a home mortgage and then waited a year and refinanced, when your house is worth another $100,000, you could take the additional $100,000 and buy the boat, the vacation, or pay your child's college tuition or put some in the bank for a rainy day. And next year, you would do it again. Now, what about those people who couldn't afford a house? The ones with no bank account, no job, just down on their luck, having cash flow problems. Along came the banks and said, hey, why don't you buy a house with nothing down and no payments for a year, and then refinance after a year when the house value has increased and the appreciated value you can pocket. These were called ninja loans, meaning no income, no job or assets loans. Banks were making those kinds of loans. Imagine how risky they would be. No credit manager would approve them. But there was a housing bubble that was never going to burst. It was housing prices increasing forever, a gravy train that would always provide. But still, what would the banks do with such shaky loans? Well, they were very clever, and they took poor loans and bundled them with some better performing or safer investments and called them securitized. The credit rating agencies managed to look the other way and give them a good credit rating. And they packaged them and repackaged them and sold them at a huge profit. Everyone was making lots of money. We suffered from an investment deficit disorder, meaning there was nothing really in those securities. And when I went to school in the 1960s, no one wanted to become a banker. I mean, what a boring job, no future. All the bright people went into science or engineering. Then in the 1980s, suddenly everyone wanted to become a banker, especially an investment banker. When asked why, the answer was obvious. That's where the money is. And we all wanted more money. So investment banking was this huge pot of gold that kept getting bigger and bigger. The credit card industry got into the game too. Remember back in the 1970s, very few of us had credit cards. But then it became easier to buy with plastic. You didn't need to carry money. So when we couldn't borrow against our home, we bought with plastic and began accumulating more debt. The banks made it easier by sending us offers every week for another credit card with 0% rates for the first year. It was sort of like the drug pusher at school giving you your first hit free. By this century, people had amassed huge credit card debt. I notice it among my students who have high student loan debts and then shuffle other debt among those different credit cards, moving it into those with no interest and getting them out before the interest hits and moving their debt into another credit card. It's not uncommon for undergraduates at UW to have $40,000 or $50,000 in debt before they graduate, and that is at a state school. Medical students typically have debts of several hundred thousand dollars. Our leaders thought all this was just fine. In 1999, President Clinton repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, which was passed in 1933 to separate the loan and investment parts of banks that had brought about the 1929 crash. But this wasn't necessary in the euphoria that hit us. President Reagan, back in 1982, weakened the law, and there were already steps afoot to give the rich everything beginning in the late 1960s. But they really took hold in the 1980s and 1990s. And the Bush years were just more fans on the flames, but the fire had started long ago. Along the way, about 2005, personal savings rates in the United States actually turned negative for about the first time in our history. We were not saving anything, and we were totally in debt. It's no surprise that since corporations didn't have to pay fair wages, and if we had to borrow our salaries, corporations amassed enormous profits. Profits had never been higher than they were in the first half of this decade. Beginning in the 1990s, people began to speak out against the banking system, and by 2002, it was clear that housing prices were way above equivalized rents, and so there was a bubble, and it was only a matter of time before it burst. The people who pointed this out were ignored. So by 2007, we had massive consumer debt, the biggest amount of mortgage and credit card debt ever, as well as a fundamental shift in the U.S. economy from manufacturing, which in the 1950s amounted to the bulk of our economy, to financial services, which was now about half of the economy, where all the investment bankers were feeding at the billion-dollar trough, and manufacturing had sunk to only about 10% of our economy. Recall, we used to make things, and now all the labels say made in China or Bangladesh or Taiwan or Korea. And along the way, our national debt skyrocketed. And then the housing prices stopped increasing and began to decline. At this point, all you needed was for someone to yell fire, and we all tried to get out of the burning movie theater at once. There's a book called Panic Rules. It says, there are two rules of behavior in any credit system. Rule number one is the rule all participants want other participants to follow. Don't panic. Rule number two is the rule each participant must be careful to follow herself. Panic first. So in 2008, guess who panicked first? The bankers. Recall how it didn't take more than a week for then-Treasury Secretary Dennis Paulson to ask for close to $1 trillion to give to the banksters. And he got it with few questions asked. And then they wanted more, so they got it. Then we got over a sticker shock, so when the next $1 trillion bailout came along, we groaned, whatever. No banker was left behind. Along came a new government, and it is still pandering to the banksters, giving them lots of cash. There were billions for bankers and pennies for people. Yet with all this cash we've injected into the banks, are they lending? No. They're sitting on more than $1 trillion of assets when they rarely have even $5 billion in reserves. Why aren't they lending? I think they're scared that there might be a run on the bank. And besides, they seem quite comfortable collecting their huge bonuses while doing no work. I didn't go into detail about the huge amounts out there in those airy-fairy investments, the derivatives, the credit default swaps, the collateralized debt obligations and such. Very few people understand what this is all about. Even the amounts in question were staggering. Credit default swaps alone were valued at over $60 trillion. That's huge, considerably more than the total production in the world. Derivatives had more than 10 times that in value. Add them all up, and we're talking several quadrillion dollars, minimum. I have trouble with large numbers. 1,000 is really big. I can't imagine 1,000,000. Forget 1 billion and 1 trillion. What galaxy are you on? But several thousand trillion? Now, many countries bought these securities thinking they were safe. Iceland's economy collapsed in the panic, and they're still trying to come up for air. There's been a global financial implosion. But the key point is, the rich decided not to share anymore after giving up half of their wealth, and now they've got it back. But there's turmoil in the world, and no one knows how long it will last. I personally think the concept of perpetual economic growth is outmoded. Growth for growth's sake is the ideology of the cancer cell, and not something most of us want. Economic growth also violates the second law of thermodynamics, so we know it can't go on. What has happened is called a crisis of liquidity. No one is buying much anymore. Businesses are full of stock they can't sell. No need to have workers produce, so more employers give pink slip parties. And the funny thing is, we don't seem to miss constantly accumulating more stuff to put in the off-site storage lockers. Everyone's trying to figure out a way to get us to buy. But I hope you resist the urge to buy more stuff you don't need, to put in a house that is so big you can't find your family, and is too far away from your friends so you can't associate with them. Economists know that when this happens, it could sound a death knell for capitalism, which depends on our believing that he who dies with the most toys wins. Trouble is, as you'll find out, he dies younger than he should. So what is going to happen? Well, I'm impressed that over in Europe, they're rethinking what an economy is for. We need to do that. All the studies show that increasing economic growth in rich countries, that is, rich countries becoming richer, is good for pretty well nothing. That is, it heats up the planet, it creates tremendous social unrest, it spawns terrorist activities and makes us less healthy than we should be. At the same time, as I said, there walk the earth now both the richest people who've ever lived and the poorest. So the poorest nations need to catch up to where we were about 40 years ago in the size of our economy. We need to downsize and they need to catch up. And we must find ways to create a steady state economy that satisfies the needs of everyone, but doesn't work for the greed of a few. That way, we'll all be happier and live more fulfilled lives, and the toll on the planet will be much less. So I presented the point of view on how the global economic crisis happened. It isn't my own, but I borrowed it from here and there. Now I want to talk about the good news. Namely, that health seems to improve during recessions. This is an interesting situation to ponder. Do things get better when things get worse? The bulk of the evidence says yes. Beginning in the 1920s, some researchers found that business cycles go in opposite directions to good things. They wrote back then that there were higher death rates during prosperity than in recession. But these were not taken seriously because we all knew things got better when we worked harder and produced more and lived the good life. But in the 1970s, research articles appeared with titles such as, quote, prosperity as a cause of death. And in the 2000s began many studies with titles such as, are recessions good for your health? And deaths rise in good economic times. By now, even our World Health Organization agrees in a report published in January of this year, quote, some counterintuitive findings come from the United States of America and Europe, where recession has been accompanied by falling mortality rates, possibly because of reduction in alcohol use and smoking and more time available for childcare, end of quote. So what the studies show is that when the economy is contracting, that is when growth rates are declining in comparison to when they're expanding, that mortality rates decline. There are fewer deaths. Like many issues in health, we can dissect them and find that some causes of death, like cancers, don't change. But other causes of death, such as heart attacks or liver disease or infections such as pneumonias, drop. One cause that declines are motor vehicle crash deaths. You can probably speculate why. People drive less because they have fewer jobs to go to. They're in less of a hurry and get less road rage and don't take such risks while on the road. A month ago, I was talking to a doctor at Harborview, our region's trauma center, and he said he was quite surprised to find that the census was down. That's where all the victims of big car crashes go to be patched up. There seem to be fewer patients in our trauma center today than during the boom time. Now, in almost any situation, those who are unemployed have worse health than those with jobs. So this really seems weird, if when there is more unemployment, that health is better. But a funny thing happens when the unemployment rate gets higher and more people are out of a job. Then the difference in your health from having a job and not having one is less. Now, some things get worse. Suicides go up in recessions. Mental health is worse. But homicides tend to go down, and that isn't uniform everywhere. People tend to drink and smoke less during recessions because it's more expensive. Another thing that is important about recessions is that because you're not working all the time, you have more time to spend with friends, with family, and with your children. People without friends die sooner than those with friends. Children need parents, and this is best not outsourced, as we've tended to do recently with childcare, or not do with having latchkey children. Those are children who have to care for themselves. We know children who are securely attached to a single caregiver as an infant do much better than those who have to deal with many different ones. And if you have more time without work, you're more likely to exercise, go for walks, and do all sorts of healthy things. Now, one study looked at unemployment rates where women in the United States conceived. They found that the higher the women's unemployment rate, the better the birth outcomes. That is, there were fewer low birth weight babies and lower infant mortality rates after the first month of life. Why would that be?
You're listening to Stephen Bezruchka on Capitalism and Health. This is AR. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Well, just think of what we know to be important for health, the early life period, and especially the first 40 weeks when you live in your mother's womb. Now, suppose she's hard at work and stressing out at work. We have studies showing that if your mother is very stressed at certain periods when you're floating around inside her, that your health outcomes are worse. She's more likely to be stressing out working than sitting at home thinking calm thoughts. And then after you're born, if she's unemployed, it will be like it was back in the 1970s with a two-parent, two-child family with one parent staying at home with the kids. We know that secure attachment to a single caregiver produces healthier offspring. So this is at work too. I'm really impressed with the findings that we have so many different studies demonstrating these effects. What about the mother of all recessions, the Great Depression of the 1930s? Just as in the 1920s, there are studies showing that health improved there as well, and it improved more when there was more relief. Now, relief is the term I recall my father using. It meant where the government and other agencies helped you, just like they're giving relief to the rich bankers today. Only back then, they gave it to those who had less, rather than those who already have way too much. So relief really was a relief from the rigors of no food and no shelter. And where there was more relief, there were better health improvements. So that brings me to a key point. Recall that we're talking about rich countries and recessions. I'm not going to talk about the situation in poor countries. Now, the benefits of recession to rich countries are not the same everywhere. There's a big benefit in the United States. That is because we work so hard and we don't have much of a safety net, unless, of course, you're a rich banker and you get your bailouts in billions. Studies in other rich countries where they have less poverty than here, where they have more income security than here, where they have a very generous welfare system, where they have universal health care and all that sort of stuff, you know, the kinds of freebies that we wouldn't want in the United States unless you're a banker, then if they have all these social supports, then the difference for health between recession and growth is not that much. They're still there, but just not as big a deal as in the United States. Again, that seems paradoxical. But if a society takes care of you, whether or not you have a job, if a society gives you parental leave and free child care and generous unemployment benefits and free education and work retraining and all the health care you need, then whether you have a job or not doesn't matter that much for your health. You will, of course, be healthier and live longer than if you lived in the United States, so the benefits of recession are less. But you're better off anyway. So let me summarize what's been discussed. I began by talking about the origins of the Made in U.S. global recession. I suggested it came about because the rich were reacting vigorously to being less rich than they used to be. They wanted their money back. And the way they got it back was by not paying our salaries as we worked harder and harder to make bigger and bigger profits for the rich. We did this by first working more jobs and longer hours for no increase in the hourly wage, and then we put our spouses and children to work. When that didn't make our income sufficient to enjoy the lifestyle we'd become accustomed to, we began borrowing our salaries. First, we borrowed against home equity and then against credit cards. Eventually, the banks responded by producing all these wonderful forms of debt that made them many trillions of dollars. But eventually, the house of cards came crashing down as housing prices collapsed. And then no amount of money that we threw at the banksters seemed to get us out of this funk. Today, we're stuck. The good news is that recessions are good for overall health. We have more time to spend with friends and family. We don't eat our hearts out and die from heart attacks. Our immune system is better and we don't die from infections as much. And we don't engage in so many bad habits, so we don't die of liver disease from alcohol and these other nasties. We spend more time with our kids, and they are better off. So where are we heading? This is the best opportunity to rethink capitalism we'll ever have in our lifetimes. Capitalism is working just as it is designed to. Every few decades, we have crises. Remember the savings and loan debacle in 1989 and all the bailouts then. This was another banking crisis of capitalism. Remember the dot-com bubble. One part of the crisis had been blamed on globalization, especially part of the corporate-centered variety we've been in. But it's much more basic than that. It's just another crisis of capitalism, and if we muddle through this one, there'll be another one in our lifetimes, or a worse one in our children's or our grandchildren's lifetimes. Actually, I think it will come sooner, since we've been neglecting the second law of thermodynamics for a long time, and it is catching up with major climatic changes. I find it interesting to compare the February 3, 2009 issues of Time magazine, both in the U.S. and the European editions. The one in Europe had Karl Marx on the cover in the headline, "What Would Marx Think?" Inside was a long article on his ideas and their relevance for today. The U.S. edition had the inauguration on the cover and not a word about Marx inside. His name is a four-letter word in the United States. Meanwhile, 2 weeks later, the February 16th cover of Newsweek in the U.S. had a blue hand and a red hand clasping horizontally with the bold red headline, "We are all socialists now," to go along with the bailouts of the rich bankers and talk of a stimulus package. But what is happening in this country can in no way be called socialism. It is more typical of socialism for the rich and market discipline for the rest of us. So our challenge is to fashion a new economic and political order. The old one clearly doesn't work. We need to face the fact that the post-carbon economy is close at hand. We must deglobalize and relocalize. Our economies and our relationships must move towards being closer together than they have been for the past few decades. We must do with less so that the countries that have much less than we do catch up. The good news is that we'll all be better off this way. No one will be left behind. So how are we going to create a new world order? The first steps are for us to acknowledge that we are all experts. We know as much as those in charge. We need to make sense of what has happened, but don't think that you know less than the so-called experts. We must form our own points of view and discuss them with others, with our neighbors, our co-workers, our friends and family. We need to organize the people we know to band together for what would be good for our health and for the health of others. It's nice to hope for change, but the change the rich want is not the change that will be good for all of us. We have to fashion the change that will heal us and bring health to our planet. To do this, we need to organize and work together. How are we going to do that? Let me close with a poem from a book by Marge Piercy called Woman on the Edge of Time that speaks of how we might work together. It's called The Low Road. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up. They can bust you. They can break your fingers. They can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wallop your lover. They can do anything. You can't stop them from doing them. How can you stop? Alone, you can fight. You can refuse. You can take what revenge you can, but they roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity in your own newsletter. 10,000 power in your own paper. 100,000 your own media. 10 million your own country. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day you mean one more. Thank you. Maybe we can have a few minutes for some questions and discussion. And there's a microphone over here. Yeah. Well, actually, go ahead and speak your question and I'll repeat it. Okay. The question is about single-payer insurance and how this is being kind of derailed in this country. First of all, the United States is the only rich country that doesn't have universal health care. That is, all the other rich countries make access to health care a priority without need to pay first. And the interesting thing about the system in this country on health care is that it is basically run by health care insurance companies. Now, in 2005, healthcare insurance companies' profits were over $100 billion. So when you have an industry with $100 billion or more in profits, it's very hard to tamper with that kind of an industry. So one of the things that's not on the table in any of the discussions right now is universal healthcare. Single payer or however you do it, there will be people left behind in the plan that's sort of being discussed in the Congress today. And that's because we basically have a profit care system of delivering healthcare. That is, if we can make a profit, we'll do something. And I've observed this as a doctor over the years. That is, you always get paid for doing more, and so you tend to do more. That's not necessarily good for us. But the insurance companies, they're the real bottleneck in this process. So the challenge is to somehow ease the insurance companies into, healthcare insurance companies into some other line of work. And so it'll only happen if there's, you know, polls show that roughly 60 or 70% of Americans want a single-payer system. But that isn't even an option. And I think it says a lot about our democracy. As Arnold Toynbee said, he didn't think the democracy will remain, that it will be essentially destroyed through the system that gives big business ever more and makes us deal with less. Why doesn't Congress give everybody the same degree of health care that our elected officials give? Somehow in this country, health care is not considered a right. It's also not, and the health of our country is not considered a fundamental right. I say this because I was in Nepal and I was talking with their constitutional assembly, and I was suggesting that they consider drafting a constitution that has a clause in it like Japan has, namely that the government is responsible for maximizing the health of the public. See, we occupied Japan in 1945, and we wrote Japan's constitution for them. And it was a five-star general, Douglas MacArthur, who, in my estimation, has been the world's greatest population health doctor. He wrote a clause, Article 25, in Japan's constitution that says the government shall work to improve the health of the people. And so by having that framed in the constitution, that's what the government's job is. And so Japan is, of course, the healthiest country in the world. We could have put an amendment in our constitution saying that that the government's responsibility is to improve the health of the people. Now, you have to recognize in doing that, that health, you know, I always ask people, do you want health or health care? It's not health care that produces health. Okay? It's all these other things. It's the nature of caring and sharing in human relationships, and especially those that act in early life that produces a healthy society. We spend half of the world's health care bill, we deliver enormous amounts of services, and we don't have much to show for it. So rather than talking about health care in the current debate, I prefer to speak about health. We do die younger, much younger than we should for living in this country, all of us. We don't excel in any indicator of health when the comparison is other rich countries. And so I think the debate needs to be shifted from the fact that we die young away from the fact that not everybody has health care. So the question is, why do we spend so much money on people who are afraid to die? First of all, there's the general belief that medical care can extend lives. There's certainly a lot to debate on whether or not that's true. We seem to believe that medical care can fix everything, when in fact it doesn't. And so we put up with a tremendous amount of physical and emotional abuse accessing medical care in the hopes that it will prolong our lives. Sometimes it does, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it hastens the demise. And I think most of us in this room can probably know of some examples where medical care has in fact not been the great savior. It's been an earlier demise. That's not to say that you shouldn't access medical care when you need it, but the benefits are much less than the media point them out to be. Now, Washington State has passed an assisted suicide law, and I think that that's a real progressive step. And I've talked to people who have some chronic illness, and they are actually considering using the law to sort of not have to suffer needlessly. This has been a part of human history for long periods of time. I mean, the Eskimos used to put, the old people would go out on an ice floe and take their final journey. There are many different ways in which we can do that. I think the key thing begins by recognizing that medical care isn't that good at prolonging lives. Yes, I think quite a number of us in this room are receiving some form of medical care that is benefiting us, but it doesn't always work that way. Remember the assisted suicide law. I think that that can be... It used to be that a pneumonia was a friend of an old person that took them away. But these days, we intervene and we make them dive with, five or six tubes coming in and out. And it's really often a horrible death. So the question is about good food and clean water and what the FDA and other agencies are doing to regulate our environment. The Europeans are really ahead of us here. They work on the precautionary principle. Namely, if there's any doubts about something, they don't allow it. Whereas our perspective is, let's allow everything, and then later if we find out something isn't working, let's sort of try and get it out of our environment. And I prefer the precautionary principle. But be that as it may, food and water and these things are actually less important for our health than the studies show. Sometime between conception and age 3, 4, or 5, sometime in that early window, half of our health as adults is programmed. Roughly half of our health is determined long before we make any behavioral choices. And the studies are very strong on that. Okay, so think about every one of us in this room began as a fertilized egg. The ovum, the mother's contribution, she had already formed by the time she was born, formed in your maternal grandmother's womb. So half of what you started with was there when your mother was born. Then the sperm comes along, and the fertilized egg then divides roughly 42 times before a newborn is hatched. That is, there are 42 cycles of cell division from that fertilized egg to produce a baby. Once that baby's born, there's about another 5 cycles of cell division to produce you. Now, think about it. If you want to influence what's going on, those 42 cycles of cell division with all the stuff that's going on in early development within the womb is incredibly influential. That's the period when we react to our mother's nutritional status throughout her lifetime, the stress she has undergone before she got pregnant, the stress during pregnancy, and all of these factors. We have many, many studies demonstrating this. And so... healthier societies where people live longer than in the United States, recognize the importance of early life, both the time during pregnancy and especially the first year of life or two after that. Because again, that's where you have more cycles of cell division. So what do other countries do to make this a better period for health? Well, they mandate maternity and paternity leave, for example. If you just go 100 miles north to Canada, you basically get a year's paid maternity leave. And if the mother goes to work, the father can take the leave. And this is paid. Okay? United States, Papua New Guinea, half of an island north of Australia, Swaziland, a South African country, and Liberia on the west coast of Africa are the only 4 countries in the world without a paid maternity leave policy. We just don't believe in that. We don't believe that we should spend any money on early life. Where do we spend our money? We spend it on, once you're age 65, and then we start throwing money at you. Take the healthier countries. They front load where the government spends money. In Sweden, for example, they spend more of government funds on the first year of life than in any subsequent year. And in Sweden, for example, it is mandatory to take a year's paternity leave. If the mother takes the full year, the father's got to take 12 weeks, and that's at full pay. Now, Sweden has high tax rates, just as we used to do, so they have lots of money to spend for this. The second year in Sweden for paternity leave, the second year of a child's life, is optional at only 80% pay. Then if you decide to go back to work, In the third year of life, you can put your child in a Swedish government-run daycare center. What are the requirements? And it's free. What are the requirements to work in a Swedish daycare center? You have to have an advanced degree in play. Because what is daycare all about? It's socializing the child. You need experts for that. So they have a very different perspective. And all the European countries are like that. Canada's better than the United States. So we need to think, rethink, do we want a healthy country or not? If we want a healthy country, what do we know about what produces health? We need to sort of say, yeah, healthcare, we need healthcare, but more important, we need health. And so we have to put in place the political policies that will produce a healthy society. In the 1950s, we used to be one of the healthiest countries in the world. Now, there's at least 30 countries whose health is better. If by better health, I mean longer lives, more happiness, actually. Happiness in the United States has been declining slowly over the last 40 years. And the decline has been biggest in, guess who? Women. It's very hard being a woman in the United States these days. You've got to be a mom, a soccer mom, a devoted wife, successful in the workforce, a jock, a model, and a porn star. It's really hard. It's really hard to do all those things. So women are just, really, the studies are remarkable in showing how happiness has been declining. Not so much in men. We're just the same jerks we've always been. But it's more so in women. Yes. Yeah, I think that's very true. We have, the best democracy money can buy. That is, we spend an enormous amount of money in influencing our politicians. Matter of fact, we don't have a democracy. We have an auction. And that is those who are the highest bidders get to control the process. And I have a friend who's thinking of running for the state legislature here in Washington State. And he's already being approached by lobbyists with big campaign contributions. And they're, of course, big businesses. They're not people like you and I. So we need to totally transform the political process and get money out of it. It just makes no sense whatsoever. So I agree. As long as healthcare is profitable, the investors in healthcare will make sure that they get a system that works for them. Well, thank you very much.
That was Stephen Bezruchka on capitalism and health. He spoke in Edmonds, Washington. Stephen Bezruchka teaches at the University of Washington and works as an emergency room physician in Seattle. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, we've always offered AR free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as David Suzuki, Bill McKibben, Ralph Nader, David Corton, Francis Moore LePay, Tariq Ali, Naomi Klein, Michael Parenti, and Vandana Shiva. To access our vast audio catalog, including other Stephen Bezruchka programs, and to find out about subscribing to AR so you don't miss a single program, we offer CD, printed transcript, and MP3 subscriptions. Go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Stephen Bezruchka on Capitalism and Health, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. And remember to support the station that airs this program. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Stephanie Brown is our editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Miles Davis and John Coltrane. Round Midnight.